High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of October 5th. Coming up on today's show,
fulfill your 8-bit coding dreams.
The PlayStation turns 25 in the UK.
A museum filled with nothing but spectrums.
A controversial controller gets a well-deserved update.
All this and more on This Week in Retro. Up-to-date news.
For out-of-date tech.
There are no more excuses, John. There's nowhere left to hide. The promises we all make to ourselves to one day learn how to code our childhood computers are now easier to fulfill than ever, thanks to a software package called Turbo Rascal Syntax or Syntax Error. And I've got to resist the urge to say Rascal like Pascal here. And I think that's the intention because this whole thing is Pascal based. I'll tell you more about it. It really is the full English breakfast for your 8 or 16-bit systems. This is a programming language in an easy-to-navigate development environment. It includes a sprite editor. It includes the ability to compile your code for everything from the 6502 to the Z80 to the 68000 CPU-based machines. So you can use this thing, Turbo Rascal, to code games for everything from the Game Boy to the C64 to the NES to the ZX Spectrum to the Amstrad CPC, anything you can think of, Amiga 500, Atari 2600, it's all in there. So what are you waiting for? it's all in there. John, have you ever coded a game or made an attempt at anything more than just using BASIC? Because we all tinkered with BASIC, I think, on our old systems. But have you ever seriously tried to code a game on an 8 or a 16-bit system?
You know, Neil, much like you and I'm sure many of our listeners, when we got our computers, we also had one or more books that promised us to turn us into coding wizards. On the front of the book, you would see the most fantastic image of a video game of all time. It might be like a wizard fighting a dragon. And you're like, man, I'm going to learn how to make that. And then you open it up. And what are you doing? You're writing simple programs to, you know, print your name on the screen. And of course, you know, you have to start small to get big. But here's the deal, Neil. I always had big dreams and I still have big dreams. These dreams do not involve coding blackjack for JavaScript or programming a single pixel to move with the joystick. I never had the patience to go through all of the basic level programming exercises to get to the point where I could conceivably produce anything like a game. And really, I'm sort of my own worst enemy, too, because I'll start out, and I've done this, I've tried to attempt to code for the Atari 8-bits over the years several times, and I start out with a very simple concept. And then it just sort of explodes out of control with all these things that I want to do and add. And I just get overwhelmed because, let's face it, I have no real skills in programming. How about you, Neil?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are no shortcuts. You've got to learn the basics. If you don't learn the basics, you're not going to get anywhere. And I tried. Boy, did I try. I tried on the Amstrad CPC. I was probably too young at the time to really grasp anything more than very light basic on the CPC. On the Amiga, I played with Amos and Blitz Basic. Again, they're both basic programming languages, although very powerful ones. It wasn't until I had a 486 PC that I really got into coding and I got into C coding. It was actually a pair of books. It was C for Dummies. I think it was by a guy called Dan Gookin. And actually, I was very new to the internet at the time. It was the mid-90s. And I always remember I reached out to him because his email address was in the book and he actually replied. And it blew my mind that I was working from this book and the author replied to me by email.
It was a different time then. It was a time when authors put their email address in books and it was the email address they actually used. And
yeah. I remember it was wonderful. I was a teenager and I was like, look, I think I want to be a programmer when I grow up. Have you got any advice? And, you know, I can't remember what that advice was, but I remember it being a really nice email.
You know, I remember buying around the same time period when the internet was first out. And this has to do, and this is something that we just don't have to deal with at all anymore, was just sometimes you just couldn't find the books anywhere locally and there was no online shopping. And so I went to the bookstore and they had HTML for Dummies, but it was volume 2. And so I was trying to jump in, you know, halfway through the curriculum.
Again, you're skipping the basics again.
And so, you know, living now when we live where we can instantly order any book on any conceivable subject, not to mention the, you know, raft of tutorials available on YouTube, plus this new Turbo Rascal, we really live in a golden age for anybody who's interested in programming.
It's true. The only reason I learned C programming on my 486 is because that book happened to be in stock in the local bookshop when I went in there, and it looked interesting. It could have been any other language. But yeah, I did try with the Amstrad, and more recently I promised myself, okay, I'm going to go back and learn how to program a game on the Amstrad. And I did try to teach myself Z80 assembly language, and with a modern emulator, you can actually get a visual, you know, you can see what's happening in the registers, and you can use online tutorials, and you can learn quite a lot. But this makes everything so much friendlier. You know, Pascal is way friendlier. It's a much more high-level language than assembly language, of course. So I think with the busy lifestyle that I have, this gives me a much better chance of going, okay, I'm going to write a program for an 8 or a 16-bit computer. Life gets in the way, and then when I come back to my code, because Pascal is a much higher level and therefore self-documenting, if you code in a fairly nice way, you know, you can come back and you can pick up where you left off. But understanding the language is just half the battle. Once you've mastered the language, you still have to come up with a game. So my question to you, John, is if you did have to make a game, or even just choose a genre of game, what would you go for?
All right, you're going to think I'm totally cashing in on a fad here, but I've always thought that you could make a great Endless Runner game based on a side-scrolling skateboard motif. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that Endless Runners are all the rage now. Everybody does them, but I thought about this idea long before I even knew what an Endless Runner was. There was a game for the NES called TNC Surf Designs. Did you ever play that, Neil?
Never heard of that one, no.
Okay, it's by all accounts not a very good game, but there is a skateboarding section in this game that I think would translate really well. It's basically, you know, you're on a skateboard and you're moving continuously left to right, and you've got to dodge obstacles and hop over things and grab items and things. I think I would love to make a game like that with a really 80s kind of, you know, West Coast aesthetic for either a retro computer or a console. I'd love to do that. That is my ultimate dream programming thing. I think it could be a real winner. What about you, Neil?
You're so down with the kids, John, with your skateboarding and your West Coast themes. I'd probably go with a side-scrolling shooter, just because it gives me lots of options to play with things like parallax scrolling with tile sets, see how many layers of, you know, parallax I can get going. And I think you could also have a lot of fun coming up with those attack patterns from the enemies, you know, coming up with patterns, reusing those patterns. Because once you've got a kind of a set of attack patterns, you know, you can just reuse them throughout the game, can't you? And then you just got to mix up the backgrounds and, side-scrolling shooters are easy. I'm just making it sound like it's a walk in the park, isn't it? You know,
you're an Amiga gamer through and through, because that's exactly what they did every single time.
Yeah.
How many layers of parallax can we do? You know, we throw in a couple generic non-animated enemies that run in various patterns. Bam, you're done. Throw in a catchy title track that you license from somebody, put a big sticker on the box saying featuring music by, and boom. Winner.
Dude, we're done. Well, I've got no excuses anymore, and nor have you, John, and nor has anyone else out there. So if you want to try and tackle that old system and come up with the game you've always dreamed of, then Turbo Rascal has been around. It's been around since 2018, but this latest update really adds a whole bunch of features to it. It's really matured nicely, both in the program and outside of it. There's lots of tutorials available, lots of lovely code examples to help you. So what are you waiting for? Go and code the next big thing.
Neil, it seems like almost every week we're celebrating an important birthday in the retro world. 25 years ago this week, Sony's very first foray into the world of gaming arrived in your native land. In the UK, the PlayStation was launched. Was it a face that launched 1,000 ships, Neil? Did it make a big impression on you at the time?
Well, we're talking about the UK, turning 25 in the UK. Was it a year earlier in the US? When did it come out in the US?
Yeah, I think it came out in I want to say that it came out 25 years ago in the US, but just earlier in the year. Like maybe it was a January, yeah. August type thing or something.
And then it was Japan before that, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But yeah, it made an impression. The impression it made on me is that it made me angry because here I was with my PC. I think it was probably a DX4 100. It might have been an early Pentium. I can't remember. But what I do remember is that PC cost me a lot of money and I was really into my gaming. So when this £299 toy came along and wiped the floor with what my PC could do in 3D gaming, I was not a happy boy at all. And the killer for me was definitely Ridge Racer. You know, do you remember the first time you saw Ridge Racer? Because that was the thing that was always, you know, streaming in the shop window as a demo.
Absolutely. This was the first time that I saw a racing game that I was like, why do people go to the arcades anymore? Because this is it.
Exactly that. Yeah. Just seeing how smoothly that ran on the machine, it blew me away because it was a game that I was still regularly playing in arcades while at college, you know, and it wasn't an old cheap arcade in the corner. This was still a premium arcade at the time. You know, it wasn't a six-year-old Neo Geo turning out 2D games. It was much newer. It was the current generation. And it was a turning point for when the power of home video game consoles were able to take on the arcade machines themselves. It wasn't at the arcade machine level, but it was a really close approximation of the experience. You know, the gap between the home console and the arcade experience was far smaller at that point than I'd ever seen before. So, yeah, it made a hell of an impression. And in brief, it made me question the value of my PC. And I sulked for a while. Yeah. How about you?
You know, it's funny that you mention the gap closing between the arcades and the home experience, because I think a lot of people forget that in the days before emulation, your mind was really good at filling in those gaps. And so even if you had a home conversion of a game that was 80% as good as the arcade, in your mind, you were basically playing the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you look at a game like Killer Instinct for the Super Nintendo, of course, if you can fire up a MAME and play the arcade version and then play the Super Nintendo version, you're going to think the Super Nintendo version looks like garbage. But in the time that it took for you to travel from the arcade back to your home, you know, and then you fire it up on your TV, your brain sort of is really good at filling in those things and visualizing the missing information and allowing you to think that, man, you know, I'm playing something that's arcade perfect almost. Yeah, so yeah. That was definitely the case. And I do think that the Ridge Racer in particular marked the beginning of the end of the photorealistic driving game in the mass market arcade for sure. In terms of the way that I was feeling, I wasn't angry. I was scared, Neil. as I mentioned before in a previous episode, I was a grade A Nintendo fanboy growing up, and I was a huge fan of Japanese role-playing games, which up to this point had arrived like clockwork year after year on the old SNES. You know, you started out, you had Final Fantasy, Chrono Trigger,
Final Fantasy. Every episode, Final Fantasy.
Every episode, you got to talk about Final Fantasy. So, you know, I remember reading in Nintendo Power that Final Fantasy is coming. It's coming to the Ultra 64. And I was pumped. But as time went on, the N64 news kept coming, but you started hearing less and less about Final Fantasy and more about these rare developed titles or, you know, things like that. And so when I heard that Sony was working with Nintendo, you know, they'd been working with Nintendo, and I remember reading an EGM that something had happened and they'd split. I figured that what would happen was, you know, with CDs, you have a greater expanse of storage. And if there's one thing that JRPGs are known for is their sweeping expanse, you know, all of these cartridges on the Super Nintendo were very expensive because they were just such massive games, not to mention the CD audio, the CD quality audio. You know, you want to have your role-playing game have, you know, fully orchestrated music. I knew that the days of me being a JRPG person on Nintendo consoles were over, and I was right. So, you know, I tried to console myself. I pretended that I actually liked the 3D Zelda games for a while, but they never scratched that itch. What I wanted was Final Fantasy VII. However, I never actually ended up with a PlayStation 1, and I've still never played Final Fantasy 7. I skipped 7 and 8 altogether, and when the PlayStation 2 was released, I bought Final Fantasy 9, which was the series, really. It was the swan song of the classic Final Fantasy games. It was the last one before it really sort of got out of control. So anyway, Nintendo broke up with Sony. Sony did their own thing, and Sony came out the winner for sure. It led to me getting out of the video game scene for years. When the games that I liked to play stopped coming out on the system that I liked, instead of buying a PlayStation, I just decided, I'm not going to really play video games anymore. And that's probably why I was able to graduate college in only 4 years. I have a feeling that if I would have had a PlayStation with Final Fantasy VII, I might not have gotten out of there, Neil.
Yeah.
Has anything like that ever happened to you? Has there ever been something that's happened in the industry that's caused you to take a break from the hobby for a while?
Well, that's quite an impact it's had on you there for, the arrival of the PlayStation to completely put you off video games. That's quite incredible. I can't remember taking a break because of anything that happened in the industry. No, there have been hiatuses from the hobby just because of life circumstances, but I don't think the industry. I do remember buying into all the hype that surrounded the PlayStation 2. In particular, all the marketing was centered around its emotion engine, and that it had so much power that it was banned from certain countries because it was a threat to national security. Because it was
Saddam Hussein denied.
You remember all that stuff, yeah, yeah. And I was so sucked into that hype. I was I hook, line, and sinker. I really bought into it. And when I got this was, I got it on release day. I was so disappointed that it didn't deliver real-time 3D and the quality of the Toy Story movie. That is what I was expecting. So the PlayStation 2, I mean, we're getting well away from the original story here, but it was the PS2 that taught me not to buy into the hype. But I never took a hiatus from anything. I always had my trusty PC to fall back on. But back when the original PlayStation came out here in the UK, the marketing surrounding the first PlayStation was all about gaming growing up. It was really geared towards the late teens, the early 20-somethings who were going into nightclubs. I remember, sometimes you'd even see PlayStations in nightclubs, and people listening to bands like the Chemical Brothers, whose music was heard in Wipeout. So it was really trying to shake off that Games Are For Kids image here in the UK. Is the same true of how you remember it being presented in the US? What was the strategy over there?
I don't really have those types of memories. Here in West Virginia, we definitely did not have the club and rave scene that you probably had around where you're from. So I'm not sure if there were any PlayStations around in the honky tonk bars here in West Virginia. But the whole games are no longer for kids thing had kind of been that path had been well worn by the Mega Drive advertising campaign. I remember seeing ads that I thought were actually pretty adult in magazines like EGM for Sega games. And they all implied that, what was available for the Nintendo was for kids. If you want to grow up and get past that, you need a Genesis.
Yeah, you have that whole Sega does what Nintendo don't and all of that.
Right. Yeah. I think that the PlayStation pitch in the US had more to do with the future and moving games forward. At the time in the mid 90s, Japan was just the epicenter of futuristic tech. And even just hearing that lady say PlayStation, in her Japanese accent, it just brought to mind all kinds of, Blade Runner-esque imagery. I don't remember any ads being marketed to older players in particular. It was nothing like the Genesis campaigns, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. So the PlayStation's prominence in the UK has not been ignored by the Royal Mail. They've included Wipeout as part of their series of commemorative stamps released last year in their video game series. And we want to thank Paul, a.k.a. Hermsky, for suggesting the story to us on our show subreddit.
A new museum has opened in Portugal, which is dedicated to nothing but ZX Spectrums. What fantastical, mystical place is this, I hear you asking, John? Well, it's a place called Load ZX Spectrum, and there's even a giant ZX Spectrum outside and a giant tape cassette player and a giant tape that you can stand in front of for a photo opportunity like you're arriving at Disneyland. And Portugal actually played an interesting part in the ZX Spectrum story because We had the Timex Sinclair factory in Dundee in Scotland where the computers were manufactured, but there was also another Timex factory in Portugal, and they made the machines for the local market there, and I think in Spain as well, but also for the USA and for Poland. And for those who enjoyed the specky there, as well as the families, there must have been many people who were employed at the Timex factory there, just like they were in Dundee.
Have you been to Dundee before? Do they have anything up there to kind of celebrate that heritage?
I've not been to Dundee. I mean, I've seen there are certain statues of lemmings in the area. Out of Dundee grew DMA Design, who became Rockstar Games. That all evolved from a computer club, which basically happened in the shadow of the Timex Sinclair factory there. I think a lot of that's moved to Edinburgh now. There is, I think it's Abbotte University. I think that's in Dundee, and that's, that was the first university ever to have a video game based degree.
Oh, so interesting.
You know, it's got to have had an influence on that. You know, it all grew out of having that Timex Sinclair factory there and the influence of the ZX Spectrum. You know, it's great to see that this factory has sprung up. I'd love to see one over here dedicated to the ZX Spectrum. But if it was your museum, John, if you had to dedicate a museum to one system or maybe a family of systems, what would it be? Just talk us through your dream museum.
Neil, I'm going to preface this with something that I tell my students quite often. This may sound incredibly lame, but I would actually love to dedicate a museum to video game packaging.
Ooh.
I've always loved, you know, boxes, system boxes, box art, packaging of any kind from gaming's early days, especially, you know, back before you could just slap a photo on everything. So much of the classic game boxes and computer boxes contain hand-drawn art that really is. I mean, I think that it's legitimate works of art. They're really, really good.
Yeah, even if you go back to like the first Acalabeth and Ultima games, you know, Acalabeth, the artwork was drawn by Richard Garriott's mum in the kitchen.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know, and a lot of those early TRS-80 and Commodore PET games are all hand-drawn on the covers, aren't they? Yeah.
The purpose of my museum would be to keep those sorts of memories alive. So, you know, packaging, ephemera, instruction manuals, anything that sort of surrounds the technology itself. How about you, Neil? What would you like to make a museum of?
Well, I love your choice. Can you imagine the theater of going to a museum and saying, "Oh, I'd really like to see a copy of Leisure Suit Larry 3, please, and Passionate Patty in Pursuit of the Pulsating Pectorals." And they say, "Yes, just sit right there, sir. Put these white gloves on, and they'll go and fetch you the big box game, and you can open it up and take the discs out." Oh. What an experience. I'm going to be pretty lame as well. I think the ZX Spectrum is a great choice because there's quite a few machines in the range. And then there's also lots of revisions within that range. And then thousands of peripherals, tens of thousands of software titles. So this museum in Portugal is just stuffed full with all of these things. It's very hard to top that. So I'm going to cheat and go with the IBM PC compatibles because that would give you pretty much a limitless hardware to tap into, all the form factors, a 40-year timeline from, you know, the IBM PC through to the present day. I feel like I'm cheating, but, you know, I think that would make for a great museum.
I think there's probably a market for people that would really enjoy seeing that evolution.
You know, instead of our dream museums, what about existing museums? Have you been to any that have really, really impressed you?
Unfortunately, you know, I haven't really been to a dedicated computer museum. I've been to a couple exhibits. One was actually in York when I was over in Sheffield going to grad school. I went to visit York, and they had in one of their sort of small museums, they had an exhibit. And it was the first time that I saw the mythical Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles game in person. I thought up until that point, I thought it was just sort of maybe a myth or a joke that was actually the name. But no, it really was the name of the game in England. I've seen a couple huge personal collections. The guy that started the National Video Game Museum here in America, it's in Texas. His name is Joe Santulia. I saw his personal collection, which the majority of which ended up in the museum. I actually went to visit him at his home and saw it. So that was really neat. But I've never been to a building dedicated to computing or gaming history. You guys in England, you guys have it all, Neil. You've got three that I know of, maybe even four. You've got the one in Swindon. You've got the one in Leicester. You've got the one in Cambridge. And of course, you've got your own cave. have you been to all of these, Neil?
I wouldn't put my cave quite high up there with those.
But, I would. I would definitely put it that high.
Yes. Yeah, I've been to those. You know, Swindon is just on my doorstep, and the Museum of Computing in Swindon is great because they actually let me borrow equipment to use in my videos in exchange for, you know, helping to get the word out there that they exist. So I love those guys. I was there today, in fact. another one that I really love is attached to the side of Bletchley Park. So Bletchley Park was a top secret place during World War II where Alan Turing was based. And they cracked the Enigma code using...
I saw that in the movie with Sherlock.
You've got it. You've got it with Sherlock. Yeah, Sherlock Holmes cracked the Enigma code. And they used the bomb machine. And, you know, there's all this wonderful history. And attached to the side of Bletchley Park is, I think it's the National Computer Museum there. And they've got all of the usual micros and things like that. But they've also rebuilt some of these big, big 1940s, 1950s machines. And, you know, they're working. You can see every cog turning and all of the calculations taking place mechanically. Well, digitally, of course, sure, you know, right. But there's a lot of mechanical components to it. It's just a really wonderful, wonderful museum because you can get both the Bletchley Park side and the Computer Museum. So that's got to be, I'm sorry, Swindon, but that's got to be my favorite at the moment.
That's the number one.
Yeah, yeah. So if you happen to be popping to Portugal, then do consider going in to see this museum. It's an impressively, you know, a really impressive looking collection from what I can see on the website. And you can find out more at loadzx.com.
You know, Neil, I just spent my whole first story talking about the sadness I felt with the release of the N64 and the subsequent demise of Nintendo's dominance in the world of JRPGs. But the truth is, I had a lot of fun with the humble N64. I was 16 when I got an N64. This was the first console I purchased after I got a car and after all my friends had cars. So the amount of time that we got to see each other.
You got a car at 16. Is that how it works over there?
Oh yeah,
16.
I mean, most people get two, Neil. I mean, I was a little bit.
We can learn to drive provisionally at 17. But I can't imagine 16-year-olds driving around it. Anyway, carry on.
It's sort of a trade-off, you know. You guys start binge drinking at 16,
and we
start
driving. This is true.
But anyway, because, you know, all of my friends lived far away, you know, West Virginia is a pretty spread out place. You can't walk to other people's houses. This was the first time that we could all sort of get together for extended periods of time whenever we wanted.
Yeah.
This was the perfect console for that. This was the lightning in the bottle. The strength of the N64, I think most people would agree, are its multiplayer titles. Mm-hmm. You know, it had the four ports built right into the front of the machine. And so it was perfect for, you know, Mario Party, four player tag team matches, and WCW NWO Revenge. And of course, hours and hours of gun battles in the stack and the facility, the bunker, playing GoldenEye. You got to remember, Neil, that I was not a PC gamer, and neither were any of my friends at the time. So we'd never heard of a LAN party. The whole, you know, Doom deathmatch thing, it was completely foreign to us. For us, our first really foray into first-person shooters, especially multiplayer first-person shooters, was GoldenEye on this N64. It was the ultimate local multiplayer machine, I think. Neil, did the N64 make such a big impact on you?
It did, and I was into my LAN parties, despite the hassle of having to lug a PC around and a CRT monitor, you know, and not being allowed to drive at that age over here. So, you know, it was a real pain going to LAN parties. But
what did you do? Did you just lug it on the bus?
We usually had an older friend who we could rope into driving us around. But yeah. But, you know, the N64 made an even bigger impact on my dad than it did on me. GoldenEye is the first and only game I think I've ever seen him get completely hooked on. I had an N64, and I kept it under the family TV because I like to play it on the big television rather than my tiny one in my room. So it was really easily accessible for him. And he's a huge James Bond fan. There was this really odd period in my life where my dad, who usually has no interest whatsoever in video games, became a video game addict. He was totally hooked. Nothing got done in the house whatsoever for weeks. And he completed GoldenEye on every difficulty level. I've never, ever seen him into games like that before or since. He was just mesmerized. So he loved it. And for me, yes, it was all about the multiplayer gaming. GoldenEye, for me, defined the N64. It was the killer game. GoldenEye, Mario Kart as well, we played a lot of. And we would play every Wednesday because that was the day when we had no lectures at college. So the guys I played it with, we were all taking computer science courses at the time. So we were bang up to date with our PCs. We were big PC gamers. But for a good period, we all opted for the N64 instead because, like you've explained, it was so easy for us to just power around one person's house, hook in the controllers. We take our own controllers with us and just lose hours and hours, days, usually on GoldenEye. And there was a strict no odd job rule as well, which was strongly enforced.
He was the short guy, right?
That's right. You got an unfair advantage with him. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. This is also the time that I remember seeing all of these. This is when around the same time that the internet was becoming a thing. And I probably didn't see these until a couple of years after the fact. But people would rig up cardboard squares to put up on their TVs, you know, to block the vision of the other. You know, and it was a really amazing time where you had all of these sort of homegrown solutions. And now people look at that stuff and they're like, why don't you just play online if you don't want somebody else to see your screen? But at the time, you know, making a big cardboard T and gluing it to the face of your TV seemed like a good idea.
Even now, you know, when you play a modern console that has split screen game support, just sharing a sofa with someone, you can't beat it. There's just something missing. Online gaming is great, but it's missing the ability to just punch someone in the leg when you need to.
Right. That physical aspect of competitive gaming. So if you are a fan of the N64 and you still enjoy going through the library, we've got some fantastic news for you here. Of course, you probably already know about EverDrive flash carts, so you can load up all the games on an SD card and go to town. You can mod your N64 for RGB output, and you can even add HDMI support so you can play on a modern flat screen. However, one thing that has always been lacking is a controller that improves upon the sort of controversial stylings of the original. Now, Neil, before we get into the shortcomings of the original controller, I think it's worth noting that the N64 as released was actually pretty groundbreaking. Not since the Vectrex console was released in 1982 had there been a mainstream console with a self-centering analog stick. And to me, who had never heard of the Vectrex at the time, I thought this was the first console that had ever had, you know, an analog stick. And the ability to, you know, control a character like Mario within a 3D space with that analog stick, I really thought, you know, this is the future. You also had the ability to add a rumble pack to the controller. A lot of people forget that the DualShock did not, you know, debut with the PlayStation. Nintendo actually had rumble capabilities in its controllers first. And Nintendo's addition of a full-size D-pad to the third, I guess, prong of the Trident-looking thing allowed gamers to play with more traditional controls if the game supported it. So really, my favorite feature was the Z trigger. That was the trigger that was under located right underneath the analog stick. And it felt just like squeezing a gun trigger. Yeah. So it was perfect for GoldenEye. And there was nothing else like that on another controller. Neil, what are your thoughts on the N64 controller?
Well, it's funny because the first time I used it, it was with Mario 64. And having that analog control to creep slowly forward or to run at full speed, it felt really good. I don't remember holding it and thinking that it was bad. And I also don't remember magazines ever saying, oh, this is the first analog self-centering stick since the Vectrex. I think everyone had forgotten that. You weren't the only one, you know. This was a revelation. Everyone was saying, oh, it's got an analog stick. This is brilliant. And GoldenEye did take some getting used to as a PC gamer who was used to the keyboard and mouse. But I do remember nailing the headshots with this controller. But when I pick one up today, I've got no idea how I managed to do that. If I hold it today, it does feel awkward and I'm completely inaccurate with it. I don't know what's happened. It just feels all wrong. And I think we've been spoilt now by the ergonomics of the pads that Sony and Microsoft brought out. You mentioned the original PlayStation pad. That when you go back, you kind of forget that it wasn't two analog sticks, like you say, all along. It was just the D-pad on the original PlayStation. Mm-hmm. So it was a revelation at the time. But since then, all of these other controllers have evolved. We've been spoiled. And none of them pursued that central analog stick, that trident design. They were always, right. You know,
I think that there's probably a good reason for that.
Exactly,
I think that
you know,
after I really feel like the Xbox 360 was a real watershed moment in terms of, you know, what a modern controller should be. You know, the original Xbox had the analog stick above the D-pad, but I really think that gaming really hit a sweet spot. Of course, Sony fans will disagree because Sony obviously has not changed their controller style in a million years. But I think there's one thing we can all agree with, and that is the N64 controller can use a bit of a facelift. And I'm here to tell you that there is one. This thing is called the Brawler 64. Gone is the trident design of the original, and it is replaced with a design that is definitely reminiscent of that Xbox 360 controller. The modernized analog stick sits right above the D-pad, as you're used to. And most importantly, to me at least, the C buttons, which were those yellow buttons on the original N64 controller, you know, those were originally designed to control the camera in Mario 64. So much of the N64 controller was just designed around Mario 64. Mm-hmm. But they're very awkward to use in any sort of gaming application. Well, they've made the C buttons full size, and it gives you 6 full-sized face buttons, which is similar to what you find on controllers sold specifically for fighting game fans. Like if you find a Street Fighter 2 pad, it's got those 6 face buttons on it. So that's what it reminded me of. Now, Neil, have you had a chance to look at this thing? Is this enough to make you dust off the C60 or the C64, the N64 in the cave and discover some hidden gems?
Yeah, absolutely. Looking at it, I want to try this out. I don't think I'll find many hidden gems because there are some absolute stinkers on the N64. There really are. But I'd love to revisit Wave Race 64. I played a lot of course, GoldenEye, Mario 64, just to see how I get on with this controller. It's going to be GoldenEye. It always comes back to GoldenEye for me with the N64. What was the follow-up to it? Was it Perfect Dark?
Yeah, Perfect Dark. Now, that one, I didn't enjoy that one as much. I think it was one of those games that you needed to have that expansion pack to get the full graphical fidelity. Remember the expansion pack that plugged right into the top of the console?
Right. So I was really into GoldenEye. By the time that came out, I'd moved on. I think I'd sold my N64. So that's a game I need to go and visit and try. So I think that would be the perfect one to try with this controller. So I think I'll do that. Does this have the rumble support in the new controller?
It does. This thing includes both rumble and memory pack support, so you can still use your old stuff. It comes with a longer 10-foot cord, so you can use that. And so it really improves upon all of the design of the original controller, while not losing any of the original controller's functionality. I'm pretty excited about it, and a lot of people are. This thing has blown by its initial Kickstarter goal of $20,000. They're knocking on, get this, Neil, $90,000 raised as of today, and there's still about 10 days to go before it closes. I think again, they've hit the sweet spot as far as pricing goes. You can order one of these for only $29, Neil. $29.
That's very fair. When you look at the price of modern game controllers, that's good.
Yeah, extremely reasonable. So if you do end up ordering one, be sure and leave us a review over on our show subreddit right under the story. We want to thank EOC Phantom for giving us the heads up on the Brawler C64. Here I need to get out of the retro scene, Neil. That's the problem. Thanks, EOC Phantom.
Today's episode of This Week in Retro comes thanks to our partners at Anchor FM. Whether you're new to the game or you have an existing successful podcast, Anchor FM offer a home where you can extend your audience and find new sponsorship opportunities to make it the most successful podcast it can be.
That's right, Neil. We love Anchor, and that's why we use them to host This Week in Retro. You should check them out at anchor.fm for more info.
So
So thank you for listening to This Week in Retro. Join our show subreddit and contribute your favorite stories from the world of retro.
Help us spread the word about the show by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing our Facebook page, or just telling a retro-loving friend. See you next week for more up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.